and cases in congregate care settings. The U.S. COVID-19 death toll surpassed 264,000 recently. Meanwhile, Thanksgiving marked the 24th consecutive day of more than 100,000 new daily cases in the U.S. Given the pandemic's disproportionate impact on the high-risk populations who live and work in long-term care facilities, even more nursing home residents, employees, and their families are expected to be negatively affected by coronavirus as long as the number of infections continue to grow. Post-Thanksgiving surges in cases are unlikely to spare this community and will likely lead to an ever higher death toll in long-term care facilities, KFF said, adding, raising questions about whether nursing homes and other facilities are able to protect their residents and if not, what actions can be taken to mitigate the threat posed by the virus. As the New York Times reported in June, when the COVID-19 death toll in long-term care facilities was just over 50,000, some critics have argued that the profit-driven nature of the private nursing home industry is underlying the problem. Since treating elder care as a commodity rather than a public good can incentivize cost-cutting or money-making measures that put people in harm's way. An investigation of long-term care facilities in Connecticut, the result of which were published in August, lent credence to that hypothesis. According to the study, for-profit nursing homes had about 60% more cases and deaths per licensed bed than non-profit ones, while larger facilities were hit harder than smaller ones, and homes serving as part of a chain had worse outcomes, as Reuters reported at the time. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse noted recently that he and Senator Bob Casey have a bill to help nursing homes protect their residents and workers from COVID-19. According to Whitehouse, it's time to pass it.
First suspended, now reinstated, but without the whip. Jeremy Corbyn has been at the center of an anti-Semitism smear campaign that has plagued the Labour Party. How did this begin and what led to the suspension of the former Labour leader? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission is the UK's watchdog on racism. After years of allegations that the Labour Party was becoming a hotbed of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn, in May 2019, the EHRC launched an inquiry. Last month, it published its findings in a report. In the report, the EHRC accuses Labour leadership of political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints, and harassment of those who complained. In a report that is 130 pages long, the EHRC found two cases of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Now, granted, that's two cases too many. Anti-Semitism is wrong. Racism is wrong. Nonetheless, this doesn't match the description that we've been hearing from the British media and political establishment for the last couple of years, that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite, or that he fostered a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and that this was widespread. Those are two completely different things. And when Jeremy Corbyn pointed this out, the day of the report's release, he was suspended.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party.
To talk more, I'm joined by Israeli-American author and activist Miko Pelid. Hi, Miko. Thanks for coming on. It's good to have you.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Miko, can I just get your initial thoughts and reaction on Jeremy Corbyn being suspended and his statement that the problem of anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons? Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Well, I think the accusations of anti-Semitism were all completely and utterly false. They had nothing to do. The attacks against him, which I believe has been in place for at least till since 2016, and against all of the people that supported him in the party, in other words, his entire support network, had nothing to do with anti-Semitism or racism. He and all of his supporters do not have a racist bone or an anti-Semitic cell in their bodies. This was a politically motivated witch hunt against anybody who might stand up for the rights of Palestinians, anyone who has progressive views on the issue, anyone who dares to criticize Israel or threaten Israel in any way, shape, or form. And the idea that an activist like him, a man of conscience like him, would occupy Downing Street 10 was, you know, the Zionists' worst nightmare, and they were not going to allow it to happen.
If we look at the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, their working definition of anti-Semitism formed the backbone of the EHRC, and this definition was also adopted by the Labour Party in 2018. Now, underneath the definition, there's a few examples of what they consider to be anti-Semitism. I quote here, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Miko, you were born in Israel, you come from a very important Israeli family, you're Jewish, and you're a very staunch critic of Zionism, of Israel, and you've also said that Zionism is racism. So, I mean, does that mean you're anti-Semitic now, according to their definition?
Yes. Absolutely. But I think it's important to clarify, Zionism is not an expression of Jewish self-determination. Zionism is an expression of Zionist self-determination and the self-determination of Israelis, not of Jews. And so what they've done is they framed it in a way that to defend themselves and also to gag anybody who would dare, who would even think to criticize Israel with this definition. So now if you tell the truth, which is that the State of Israel has no legitimacy and is founded on a racist ideology, you're automatically anti-Semitic. But both of these claims are true whether they call you anti-Semitic or not. But yes, definitely, according to their definition, I am, and many of my people I respect, and certainly Jeremy Corbyn, and others, and all the Palestinians, by the way, every single Palestinian is also anti-Semitic.
So, Miko, we know that the neoliberals in the party, the Blairites, have tried very hard to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. However, how extensive would you describe the role of the Zionist lobby in getting Jeremy Corbyn suspended? Because, you know, a lot of people know what AIPAC is in the U.S., for example, but I don't think they really understand that Israel also plays a political role in the United Kingdom.
Well, there are AIPAC equivalents in every single country in Europe. And obviously, Britain is a very, very crucially important country. And so there are the same kind of Zionist agents working there as there are in the United States. You have what they call the Board of Deputies of British Jews. You've got different Zionist groups within the different parties, the Labour Party and excuse me, and so on. So they work and they actually work very closely with the Israeli embassy. In order, right. And there's no question that as soon as it was clear that Jeremy Corbyn was going to lead the Labour Party, they were going to do everything they possibly could to make sure he would not enter Downing Street 10. And the New Liberals, the Blairites, of course, were great allies, and they were happy to work together. There's no question about that.
Ayelet Namias Verben, she's a member of the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, and just after Corbyn was suspended, there's a video of her boasting, essentially, that she played a role. She was a piece of the puzzle, as she says, in getting him suspended. What's your reaction to that video? What did you make of that?
It's not surprising because this is well known. I mean, Israel did everything they possibly can, and they're proud of their so-called accomplishment. They see this as an accomplishment. The bringing down of a man who dedicated his entire life to fight racism and fight injustice is what they take pride in, because the state of Israel represents racism and injustice. And so what is absurd here, that people who represent the state of Israel or different aspects within the Israeli political spectrum who are racists, who are engaged in a racist, in operating and maintaining a racist state, who are engaged in what can only be described as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, are accusing Jeremy Corbyn, who spent his whole life fighting these things, as racist and anti-Semitic. And what is very, very, very worrisome is that they succeeded. They succeeded in a very big way, and the rest of the world is watching this and just nodding instead of standing up and saying, "Are you out of your minds? This is absurd."
Nico, how do you feel that this political witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn fits into the larger scheme of actually fighting anti-Semitism globally?
Well, look, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. I mean, if somebody's an anti-Semitic, they're probably racist against everybody else too. Racism is racism. And so I think what's important is to fight racism and to promote tolerance everywhere, which of course this is why Israel is not, as they some people claim, the response to the Holocaust. Number one, most Jewish people who survived the Holocaust did not go to Israel. And number two, another racist regime is never a response to a racist regime somewhere else. What we need is more tolerance. What we need is to fight racism. What we feel is to fight bigotry and to fight and to resist violence and so forth. So, you know, fighting racism is important everywhere. It's a problem everywhere. Racism, anti-Semitism, all forms of racism are problematic, and they all need to be fought with the same vigor, with the same passion that Jeremy Corbyn actually displayed his entire life, and the people around him that were also brought down displayed their entire life. So if people really care about anti-Semitism, Jeremy Corbyn is their man.
Thanks very much for coming on, Miko. Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Jeremy Corbyn has made it extremely clear on many occasions that he opposes anti-Semitism and that it has no place in the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn is someone who's fought against racism his entire life. He's known for that, both in the UK and outside, internationally. This is a guy who's fought against racism in all forms, against anti-Semitism. He's championed the rights of workers. He's an anti-imperialist. He's an anti-war voice, an advocate for peace. Despite this, despite Jeremy Corbyn's unimpeachable record, the British media, the British political establishment, and the Zionist lobby have spent the last couple of years attacking him relentlessly and trying to smear him as either an anti-Semite himself or someone who enabled a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, I myself have criticized his handling of the issue, but to call the man a racist or that he is someone who enables racism is utterly absurd and ridiculous. What this all comes down to is the neoliberal establishment, the British media, the Zionists will be trying to get rid of pro-Palestinian voices, trying to get rid of and purge the actual left within the Labour Party. Anti-Semitism is a serious issue and it should be opposed by the Labour Party. fighting against racism is a fundamentally leftist value. And that's why we shouldn't confuse anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which is unfortunately what the media, what Keir Starmer, the now Labour leader, is doing. Keir Starmer himself has said that he is a Zionist without qualification. This man is a clear supporter of the Israeli apartheid state, and the last couple of years we've seen not just Corbyn but other voices championing the rights of Palestinians being purged, being kicked out of the party, being reprimanded, being suspended. There's a clear drive here to get rid of people who stand up to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by the Israeli occupation. Chris Williamson, who's also a former Labour MP and a close friend of Jeremy Corbyn, was also unfairly suspended from the Labour Party. Chris is a staunch anti-imperialist, he's a real leftist, and he's fought against racism his entire life as well. I'm joined by him now. Hi Chris, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me, I appreciate it. It's a real honour, thank you. I mean, I'm a big admirer of your work.
I really appreciate it, thank you. Chris, can I just get your initial thoughts on the EHRC report and Jeremy being suspended?
Well, I mean, the EHRC is a discredited organisation. It's a partisan organisation. It's been accused of institutional racism. It doesn't have any black or Muslim commissioners on its board. And indeed, two of the black and Muslim commissioners that it did have on the board were removed because they were deemed to be too loud and vocal about issues of race. They're very close to the Conservative Party, had a strong relationship as well with the New Labour, former New Labour government, New Labour regime, and they've come forward with a partisan report. I mean, I think the conclusions are written before the report had actually really, you know, seen the light of day, frankly. At the end of the day, they were trying to make the assertion that the Labour Party had a massive problem with anti-Semitism, that it was institutionally anti-Semitic. They didn't make that finding about institutional anti-Semitism, but they did actually argue that Labour was guilty of unlawful conduct and harassing the Jewish community based on two cases, two questionable cases, it's got to be said. They had six people initially in the initial report, six. And as a result of the legal representations that I made, they removed my name and three others. And they were left then with two people. And the way the corporate media has covered this, as if this is some terrible, shaming revelation about institutional anti-Semitism inside the Labour Party, when it's anything but. I mean, even if you accept at face value, two people out of a membership of 500,000 hardly constitutes a major problem for the Labour Party.
I wanted to ask you more about how you litigated and got your name removed from the report. Can you tell us more about that?
Basically, to be threatened them that if they didn't remove my name, that I would take further legal action against them in the High Court to restrain them from publishing the report, and wouldn't be satisfied with anything short of my complete removal from the report, because I was anything but what they were accusing me of doing. I've spent my life fighting racism going back to the 1970s, actually putting my personal safety at risk, confronting fascists on the street in the 1970s. And indeed on building sites when I was a young apprentice bricklayer, when casual racism was quite a thing in the 1970s in the UK. And I would regularly challenge the casual racism that I heard at that time on building sites, and, you know, nearly got beaten up on more than a few occasions. So, you know, I'm not going to take any lectures from people who are bad faith actors and attempting to try and, you know, smear somebody, you know, with my record. And indeed, somebody with Jeremy Corbyn's record, which is an unimpeachable anti-racist record, and yet he's being demonised in the way in which he speaks. Absolutely outrageous.
It really cannot be overstated how much the British media hate Jeremy Corbyn and have relentlessly attacked and smeared him during the last couple of years. I mean, to begin with, the vast majority of printed media in the United Kingdom is right-wing, okay? But even liberal left publications like The Guardian led the charge against Corbyn and smeared him relentlessly, and still are. Not even Ed Miliband or Gordon Brown or Tony Blair, the war criminal who destroyed Iraq, who has the blood of a million Iraqis on his hands, was smeared to this level by any of the mainstream media in the UK. Think of that. Think about how Bernie Sanders is smeared in the United States, except 100 times worse. Okay, Jeremy Corbyn has been called anything you can imagine. He's been called a jihadist sympathizer. He's been called a terrorist. He's been accused of wanting to abolish the monarchy and the army. He's been accused of a million things under the sun. So the mainstream media were not just complicit, they were more than happy to participate in this targeted smear campaign against leftists in the Labour Party, and specifically Jeremy Corbyn. It's not just conjecture, it's not just speculation or me saying that. This is actually backed up by raw data. A report by The Independent found that 75% of media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn was negative and factually misrepresented him. That is astonishing. For anyone to objectively say that Jeremy Corbyn has not been the target of a smear campaign by the Zionist lobby, by the political establishment in the UK, by the British media themselves, is utterly delusional and dishonest. But frankly speaking, these attacks don't just come from the Zionist lobby or from the British media. They also come from within the Labour Party itself. Even though Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership contest in 2015 by attracting a lot of new members to the Labour Party, a lot of youth with his anti-war message, with his populist message, this didn't change the fact that a lot of his colleagues in the parliamentary Labour Party are liberals, are Blairites, are to the right of him. They even tried to oust him in a coup, in a vote of no confidence in 2016. This vicious smear campaign by all of these actors is what contributed eventually to Labour's catastrophic loss a year ago in the 2019 elections. However, this witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, against the left wing of the Labour Party, didn't stop after the loss of the election. When Keir Starmer took over, who again is a Zionist without qualification, as he says, and a former prosecutor and former British intelligence, when he took over, he continued to persecute the left wing of the Labour Party. He appointed a bunch of Blairites to his cabinet, and he interfered in what was supposed to be an impartial investigation. Starmer suspended Jeremy Corbyn not even 24 hours after his comments about the EAHRC report. Again, Corbyn acknowledged there was a problem with anti-Semitism. He just said that it was blown up by the media, which is factually true. Keir Starmer suspended him, and last week when the National Executive Committee reinstated Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour member, Keir Starmer withheld the whip, meaning that Jeremy Corbyn is now standing in Parliament as an independent. So even though he's back in the Labour Party, he is not back in the parliamentary Labour Party. Chris, you were suspended from the Labour Party in 2019, very unfairly, I might add, and now Jeremy Corbyn as well. Do you feel there's been a targeted campaign against pro-Palestinian voices or anti-Zionist voices within Labour?
Most definitely. I mean, the Israel lobby is all over this. I mean, the two complainants to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission are out-and-out Zionist organisations, the so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the Self-Styled Jewish Labour Movement, are both out-and-out Zionist organisations. And there is no doubt that that was the agenda to take out prominent pro-Palestinian voices. It was unconscionable to them to have someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who was an anti-imperialist, somebody who was very supportive and sympathetic to the cause of the Palestinians, somebody who had set his stall out to implement an ethical foreign policy were Labour to get into office, and indeed had appointed a shadow minister for peace and disarmament. They took out Ken Livingstone, who was a prominent anti-racist, probably somebody who'd done more for the cause of anti-racism than anybody, actually, any politician in Britain when he was leader of the Greater London Council and then the London Mayor. Absolute solid anti-racist. He was one of the first high-profile casualties. And then people like Mark Wadsworth, a well-known black anti-racist, who introduced Nelson Mandela to the Stephen Lawrence family and was very instrumental in you know, supporting the Lawrence family in getting some semblance of justice for their son. He was thrown under the bus. He was accused of being a bigot and anti-Semite. Somebody who's an out-and-out, you know, anti-racist. Jackie Walker, another vice chair of Momentum, a black Jewish prominent member of the party, an anti-racist trainer. She was also taken out, and because we had a unique moment in history where we could have had a socialist government in Britain that would have transformed the economic landscape in Britain for British citizens and tackled grotesque inequality, but also, more significantly, I think, in many ways, had an anti-imperialist foreign policy that would have been incredibly sympathetic to and supportive of the Palestinian people and would have really held the rogue Israeli state's feet to the fire in relation to the way in which they're flagrantly disregarding their international law obligations and so on. That was unconscionable. That was what this was all about.
Why do you think they're going to such lengths if Corbyn's no longer the leader anyway and we've got Keir Starmer who's heading Labour now?
It's part of this maximalist strategy that they are absolutely keen to utterly crush any semblance of a kind of a progressive left inside the Labour Party, or the Labour Party being a potential vehicle for an ethical pro-Palestinian policy, and a socialist, anti, sort of corporate capitalist party. And what they're determined to do is to create a safe opposition, I can put it like that, a party in Britain, which is right. Essentially the flip side of the current government. You know, we've got two establishment parties that are two sides of the same coin. In the same way that in the United States we have the Democrats and the Republicans, which in reality doesn't really matter who gets into government. You know, nothing much changes, and that's where we're at in Britain now. And that's why I think we absolutely, in my opinion, need to, in Britain, be working to build an alternative movement and ultimately an alternative electoral vehicle, because I think the Labour Party is utterly broken. And what I've been saying is that the best thing we can do is to, the kindest thing we can do is to kill it and start again.
Two sides of the same coin. Overseas operations bill going through, spy cops bill going through, no opposition whatsoever from Labour. I mean, it's pathetic, it's grotesque. What is the future of the Labour Party? Is there one at all?
Look, Labour as a vehicle for socialism, as a vehicle for progressive change, it's over, it's finished. You know, Tony Benn, the great Tony Benn, great socialist, to best leader, best prime minister this country never had, used to talk about the new Labour cuckoos attempting to take over the Labour nest. Well, they've absolutely not just taken it over, they've absolutely destroyed it and broken all the eggs in the Labour nest. And it's impossible to put broken eggs back together. And we therefore need to, in my opinion, focus on building a new nest. But it won't be easy to build a new party. But it's not impossible. It's been done in the past. I mean, look, you know, back in the day, the duopoly system that existed in Britain, two-party system, was between the Liberals and the Conservatives, and then Labour broke through. You know, so it can be done. It can be done. And as I keep saying, you know, with solidarity, anything is possible, and you know, there are more of us than them at the end of the day, and we've just got to give people confidence that, you know, we can actually make a difference.
Thanks very much, Chris, for your time. Really appreciate you coming on. I have to say, I'm in complete agreement with what Chris said, with what Miko said. Unfortunately, the Corbyn experiment is dead. Whatever chance the Labour Party had of actually being a vehicle for anti-imperialism, being an anti-war movement, being a party that champions the rights of workers, that actually fights for Palestinians, is gone. It has been taken over once again by the liberal establishment, by the Blairites, who are now working in tandem with the Conservatives, with the Tories, to promote authoritarian, absolutely Orwellian policies, like the Overseas Operations Bill, which legalizes war crimes by British soldiers, or the Spy Cops Bill, which gives undercover government agents the right to commit crimes, any crimes. This is absolutely frightening. There is no more opposition party in the UK. And whatever chance there was at having one is also gone. This shows us once again the reach of the Zionist lobby and how far they are willing to go to silence pro-Palestinian voices and anyone who speaks out against their persecution and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, who exposes their war crimes. This should frighten anyone who actually cares about having a democracy and about fighting racism in all of its forms. And anyone who is denying that this was a political witch hunt, that this was politically motivated, that this was a targeted campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, against his allies, and against the true leftist and anti-imperialist wing of the Labour Party, is lying to themselves. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. America's coronavirus surge showed no sign of abating over the Thanksgiving holiday, as cases in the country surpassed 13 million on Friday, 27th of November. Thursday marked the 24th consecutive day that the U.S. reported more than 100,000 new COVID-19 cases, and the 17th day straight that the number of patients in hospital with the virus has hit a new record. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Miranda Bryant. The piece is titled, U.S. Surpasses 13 Million COVID Cases as Experts Urge Caution Over Thanksgiving Weekend. Stay with us for more of Miranda Bryant's article. America's coronavirus surge showed no sign of abating over the Thanksgiving holiday, as cases in the country surpassed 13 million on Friday, 27th of November. Thursday marked the 24th consecutive day that the U.S. reported more than 100,000 new COVID-19 cases, and the 17th day straight that the number of patients in hospital with the virus has hit a new record. There were 110,611 new cases reported on Thursday, according to Johns Hopkins University figures, and 1,232 new deaths. On Friday, the number of people in the U.S. who have contracted the virus hit 13,047,202, the university's Coronavirus Resource Center showed. And more than 264,624 people have died, by far the largest totals for any country in the world. On Thanksgiving Day, there were 90,481 people hospitalized, according to the COVID Tracking Project. Meanwhile, medical centers warned they were nearing capacity. With millions of Americans ignoring government recommendations not to travel for the Thanksgiving holiday, over a million people passed through airport checkpoints on Wednesday alone, according to the Transportation Security Administration data. Health experts warned that infections and deaths will continue to soar in the coming weeks. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, predicts the total number of deaths could rise to as high as 321,000 in the next 4 weeks, according to its latest forecast, updated on Wednesday, 25th of November. I don't mean to be scary, but today can change the course of COVID for our country for the rest of the year, Dr. Megan Rani, an emergency physician at Brown University, told CNN on Thursday. Dr. Rani said, infections that are sustained today are going to show up in 3 weeks and are going to show up in deaths over Christmas and New Year, and are going to spread in every state. Dr. William Schaffner, professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University, warned of a surge upon a surge in the next couple of weeks, telling the broadcaster, "We're in for a tough time." Among the worst affected states are North and South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, and New Mexico. With the Center for Disease Control, CDC maps show they've all seen between 102.8 and 155 cases per 100,000 people in the last 7 days. Other states in this bracket are Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Nebraska, and Utah. Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert, has warned that Thanksgiving could mark the start of a dark holiday season, and he expects Christmas and New Year to continue in a similar vein. If the surge takes a turn of continuing to go up and you have the sustained greater than 100,000 infections a day and 1,300 deaths per day, and the count keeps going up and up, I don't see it being any different during the Christmas and New Year holidays than during Thanksgiving, he told USA Today. Dr. Anthony Fauci said he probably plans to ditch any Christmas plans like he did for Thanksgiving, which he spent with his wife away from their three daughters. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease director, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said the country is in a vulnerable position heading into the holiday season because infections are too high to control surges when they arise, as he is confident they will in the winter months. As the pandemic rages, more Americans are flying despite CDC pleas not to travel for the Thanksgiving holiday. But nearly 3 million air travels pass through airport security checkpoints under Friday, Saturday and Sunday before Thanksgiving. Sunday, 22nd of November, was the single busiest day at airport checkpoints since March. As COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations and deaths continue to rise nationwide, states are imposing new coronavirus-related restrictions. Several states are putting limits on social gatherings, adding states to travel quarantine lists, mandating wearing a face mask, and encouraging residents to stay at home. Others are restricting business hours of operation and limiting restaurant capacity. Jody Guest, the professor and vice chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, said the country probably won't see the benefits of these new restrictions by the Christmas holidays. Everything we do has implications 4 to 6 weeks out. She said these prevention measures will keep people alive for the holidays, but I don't think there are licenses to go have Christmas parties the way we have in previous years. While it's hard to miss the holidays with family, Professor Guest said the US needs to make some huge course corrections, including mandatory wearing of face masks, social distancing, and avoiding large gatherings. Small gatherings are risky too. Although there isn't much data available on small gatherings, experts speculate they could be one of the major drivers of the pandemic, especially when they include multiple households. Meanwhile, Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert, said, given the cold weather and given the fact that these types of celebrations, as wonderful and beautiful and traditional as they are fundamentally indoor things with people who will be singing and laughing and eating and drinking, you've just got to be more careful.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Daher in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British Mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped and taken back inside for another 6 month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor present conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
The French police are one of the toughest and most brutal in Europe when it comes to the use of force, with multiple examples of this demonstrated by the likes of the Compagnie Républicaine de Sécurité, or the elite CRS, when dealing with the various waves of protests that have marred the presidency of Emmanuel Macron, and is why the French public and media have turned to real-time technology to film the brutality demonstrated by the French police and security apparatus. The resulting anger demonstrated in various protests across the country against the bill has quite rightly angered the French, who expect some form of transparency in the way their country is run, how public services such as the police deal with situations, and also important is the notion of being able to justify such use of force, which, as we saw in the US with the murder of George Floyd, only takes a moment's lapse in concentration to breach the thin blue line. With the ability to film and photograph any moment with the use of a smartphone and cameras, the French appear to want to hide the actions of the police, meaning Article 24 of the new bill now makes it illegal to distribute images of police officers on duty, especially if it may harm their physical or mental integrity. But what about the integrity of the officers themselves acting out their duties? Should that not also be something that should be open to scrutiny? A recent example of police brutality in France is the recent removal of migrants who were camping in Place de la République in Paris's 12th arrondissement, in which bystanders and witnesses described the amount of force used by the police as shocking, once again raising the question as to just what kind of security apparatus the French government wishes to deploy. But for many lawmakers in France, the introduction of the bill is also being met with some opposition, in particular within the French Parliament, with one lawmaker claiming that whilst it's acceptable that police officers should be able to complete their jobs without being threatened or harassed, at no point should public freedoms be breached, claiming that this bill may not change much at all, even when introduced. When the people took to the streets during the French Revolution, the motto following the toppling of the bourgeoisie became indoctrinated into the values that France still claim true today, namely the famous three words of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, or freedom, equality, and fraternity. Yet today, in modern France under Macron, all three of the coined terms appear to have less meaning, as the freedom to film the actions of the police in public places has been taken away. The equality between classes grows ever wider as Macron protects his elite friends from taxes at the expense of the poor. And fraternity is a joke as religious, racial and social discrimination run rife in France. The division in France has never been greater when it comes to religion, with France currently embroiled in yet another controversy as the publication of offensive cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad had been labelled as freedom of speech by Macron, much to the distaste of many who have taken to the streets around the world to protest this, and leaving religious leaders in France calling for some notion of unity, proving that Islam is a religion of peace. With Macron also causing huge division within France on other fronts, with the increase in duty on fuel sparking the Yellow Vest movement, and the failed policy on reforming the pension scheme costing the regular worker thousands of euros, it seems that with every step Macron takes, the more unpopular he becomes, with the so-called security bill just passed protecting the police, further cementing the fact. It can therefore be argued that Macron is the most unpopular president France has ever had, even surpassing the legacy left behind by François Hollande, as he divides his country, favours the elite, angers the international community, and essentially washes away his chances of being re-elected, needing a miracle over the next 2 years if he's really able to save his extremely fragile grip on his country.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds 2 was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds 2 cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction? The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The Naval Fleet of Iran Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multi-purpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and actually the Caspian Sea and south and north of Iran, it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. The tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone the Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
this
for
is,
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life. Here on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. In the previous program, dear brothers and sisters, we were talking about the envious judge, the judge who was the head judge of the Muslim Ummah, appointed by Mutawakkil, the Abbasid Khalifa at the time of Muhammadul Jawad alayhi salam. And we saw how envious he became when the Khalifa sided with the young Imam at the age of 25, who had more knowledge than all the other judges. And he went according to the Imam's decree, verdict, and punished that thief. And here he talked about this with his good friend, the store owner, Zaraqa. And the judge said that he will not rest before or until he punishes the Imam. And Zaraqa tried to advise him against it, but he did not accept any advice. Why? Because envy had taken over his whole being, dear brothers and sisters. When envy takes over your whole being and you do not control it, you do not manage it, then you will see that you will commit acts which you never imagined that you would do, only because you want to destroy that person. You want to destroy your friend or your colleague or whoever who got the promotion or whoever who was accepted in that university, which you also wanted but couldn't be accepted. You were not accepted. And you see that this envious feeling, this envy is taking over. And you do whatever you want to do to harm that person. You want to inflict harm. And this was the same thing that happened with this head judge. So the next day he went to the Khalifa and asked him, the judge went to the Khalifa and asked him, "Do you know what happened yesterday? Instead of suppressing the person whom a large number of Muslims consider as their imam, and as the rightful Khalifa of the Prophet ﷺ, who consider you to be unjust, you put him forward and strengthened him. Those who thought he was the rightful Khalifa are now saying, didn't you see? Even the Khalifa understands that he is higher. They are saying that he is better than others. What a big political mistake you made. He kept